Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 20th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Larry Rasmussen. Today he will be continuing his series on spirit-borne creation. Today's session number is 5 and is titled Water-Borne Spirit. Let's listen in.
Larry Rasmussen, this is a series concluding this week called Spirit-Borne Creation. The Holden theme for the summer is water-washed, spirit-borne. Nice pictures, if you haven't seen the stationery, where the banners have water-washed on one side and spirit-borne next to it, and you see the movement in both. And I wanted today to talk about water-borne spirit. I wanted to open with a prayer from the Iona community. It's a prayer which is in the few sentences of the prayer that we will pray is filled with spirit-borne water, or water-borne spirit. So let us pray. O God, open to us today the sea of your mercy, and water us with full streams from the riches of your grace and springs of your kindness. Amen. This is from the Iona Community Worship Book. Some of you know about Iona. It's an island community off of Scotland, rooted in the Celtic tradition, or if you're from Boston, then it's the Boston Celtics, Celtic tradition. I'm always interested when I see materials rooted in the Celtic tradition, because it's an old Christian tradition that got up and running before the missionaries from the Mediterranean basin, who had been influenced by Hellenistic or Greek Christianity, got their foot in the door. And if you look at the ecumenical creeds, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, what you have basically is kind of denatured Christianity. There are no symbols of nature in the great creeds, because it comes from a stream of Christianity in which the task in part was to convince a Greek mind of the viability of Christian faith. And it comes from an Augustinian tradition in which communion with God is really the communion of the mind with the Spirit of God, and you leave things of earth behind as you ascend to God. Well, the poor Celtics didn't know about this, so their Christianity is just full of the images of nature. And if you read a Celtic creed, you'll see images of rocks, trees, water, sun. I mean, these folks didn't know when you said Son of God whether you spelled it S-U-N or S-O-N. And if you look at the Celtic cross, at the crossing you have a sun. Because their Christianity was not a denatured Christianity. So the back of the Iona Community Worship Book has a goose on it. And it says, the wild goose is the Celtic symbol of the Holy Spirit. There you have it. In my town, New York, we use a pigeon. A dove in other places, but these folks got the wild goose. Okay, well, the series here this week, before we move to specifically to water, the series has been based on some important assumptions. I am assuming as is the theme at Holden this summer, water washed, spirit born, that the Spirit of God that was present at the creation, brooding over the waters, is the breath of God in creation. So that the same Spirit who was the Creator, and I use some of Luther's language and put it on the board here, Spiritus Creator, is Spiritus Presence, the same Spirit of God, present in, with, and under the elements of nature, just as Christ is present in, with, and under the common elements of bread and wine, so God is present in, with, and under rocks and trees and water. That's one of the assumptions. Right from the first two verses of the first book of Genesis, in the beginning when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. And then it has a little after God, it has a tiny little B that sends you down to the bottom of the page, right-hand column, and says, for wind of God, or while the Spirit of God. Those two are interchangeable, because in Hebrew, the word for breath, or air, or wind, ruach, is the same as the word for spirit. So I am assuming, put it in different language, the presence of the incarnate God, and I told folks earlier in the week that I've got a nice icon, it's a poster from an icon, in which it's, the icon is from the Orthodox tradition named the incarnate God, and the figures on the icon are a tree, a mountain, a river, and the sun. There isn't a human being on the scene, but that's the incarnate God. It's this tradition of Spiritus Creator is also Spiritus Presence. Or again, in Luther's words, he wrote in Latin some of the time and in German some of the time, this time in Latin, Finitum capax infiniti, the finite is capable of bearing the infinite. That's what that phrase means. The transcendent is immanent. God is present in the ordinary, everyday things available to us through our senses. I remember when I was a student at Union, I remember a conversation with Rabbi Abraham Heschel, who came to Union as a guest professor. We had to change the bylaws of the seminary because the bylaws said that only Christians could teach at Union Seminary. So we had to make a change in the bylaws that permitted the Jewish scholar to teach there as well. And he taught New Testament, which was kind of interesting. But I remember a conversation with Rabbi Heschel, and I don't remember how we got started, but he said the Jewish difficulty with Christian confessions and affirmations is not the confession of Christians that God is an incarnate God. No Jew has a problem with God being incarnate, present, in with and under the pillar of fire, cloud, water, rocks. That wasn't the problem. The problem that he had with Christians was their claim that both history and nature were already redeemed, when apparently, and for him obviously, it was not quite so. Didn't look like a redeemed world, and Christians claim that it is redeemed in Christ. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. All right, so that's one assumption for the comments about spirit-born water, or one could say water-born spirit, and the series. Another assumption that we've made during this week is that the modern world, roughly the last 500 years, has been one where you've had in both industrial capitalist societies and in industrial socialist societies, a kind of leeching of the sacred from the ordinary everyday world around us. So that at the same time that you've had a kind of leeching of the sacred from trees, the rocks, the mountains, the people you're with, you've had a kind of progressive commodification of the world as well, and most all relationships become moneyed relationships. So trees start looking like lumber, and rocks start looking like ore, and water starts looking like water rights. There's a progressive commodification that goes parallel with a progressive leeching of the sacred. The third assumption is that that's a disaster, and that all of us now somehow or another need to be newly converted to earth, and that Christianity, if it is to make a contribution to the needs of our age, must become a genuine earth faith. And what I've tried to do this week in having a couple sessions on trees and some on darkness and now one on water is contribute in a small way to a conversation that tries to say how it is Christianity can become a genuine earth faith. Because all faiths in our time now need to be judged in large part by their contribution to the well-being and redemption of Earth, ourselves included. So, we've been revisiting the elements of nature for their religious and moral guidance in a time when we need all to be newly converted to the Earth. And I want to close out the week with the same excerpts from a poem by Maya Angelou that we used earlier on. I used it when we talked about a tree. This time I want you to listen to these excerpts from her poem. The poem itself is called On the Pulse of Morning, M-O-R-N-I-N-G, and it's in a book which is available in the bookstore, the complete collected poems of Maya Angelou. This time, instead of listening for the tree, you might listen for the river. And I brought the baptismal font over from the village center so that we had a rock, a river, and a tree. So you got to use your imagination, but you have to do that in this session anyway, so might as well get into the act here. You might just want to listen, look, while you listen. This is part of the poem that was composed for the last presidential inauguration. A rock, a river, a tree, hosts to species long since departed, marked the mastodon, the dinosaur who left dried tokens of their sojourn here on our planet floor. Any broad alarm of their hastening doom is lost in the gloom of dust and ages. But today, the rock cries out to us, clearly, forcefully, come, you may stand upon my back and face your distant destiny, but seek no haven in my shadow. I will give you no hiding place down here. Across the wall of the world, a river sings a beautiful song. It says, come, rest here by my side. Each of you, a bordered country, delicate and strangely made proud, yet thrusting perpetually under siege, your armed struggles for profit have left collars of waste upon my shore, currents of debris upon my breast. Yet today I call you to my riverside if you will study war no more. There is a true yearning to respond to the singing river and the wise rock. So say the Asian, the Hispanic, the Jew, the African, the Native American, the Sioux, the Catholic, the Muslim, the French, the Greek, the Irish, the rabbi, the priest, the sheikh, the gay, the straight, the preacher, the privileged, the homeless, the teacher. They hear, they all hear the speaking of the tree. They hear the first and last of every tree speak to humankind today. Come to me, here, beside the river. Plant yourself beside the river. The horizon leans forward, offering you space to place new steps of change here on the pulse of this new day. You may have the courage to look up and out and upon me, the rock, the river, the tree, your country. Here on the pulse of this day, you may have the grace to look up and out and into your sister's eyes and into your brother's face, your country, and say simply, very simply, with hope, good morning. That's just a portion of the longer poem, which I commend to you. Some of the richest literature now in kind of, I don't call it environment, because we tend to still talk about environment as that which surrounds us. We don't consider ourselves a part of it. I never know quite what to call this, maybe just earth, ourselves included. Some of the richest literature is being written by African-American women, and Maya Angelou's poem just reflects the kind of texture of that. Just a few facts about water before Sonia and I read a short, very short script. And then after that, I want us to go to discussion together. If one had not consulted human beings, but took a Gallup poll among all Earth's creatures and asked what the name of the planet should be, it might have been named water rather than Earth, since 70% of the planet is water, and there's more life in the water than there is on the dry land. Our bodies actually mirror that in a certain sense. That is to say, our bodies are 70% water as well. 3% of the planet's water is fresh water. It's a very small percentage. It's still a lot of water, because there's a lot of water around. But in terms of percentages, 3% of the planet's water is fresh water. The rest is salt water. Of that 3%, most of it is captured in the polar ice caps. And of the rest that isn't frozen in the polar ice cap, most of that is captured in some very large lakes around the world. Lake Baikal claims, the Russians claim that Lake Baikal has 1/4 of the planet's fresh water, other than that frozen in the polar ice caps. I'm not sure if that's the case or not. The Great Lakes of the Canadian-United States border, the Great African Lakes, Victoria, Tanganyika, Malawi. So probably something like 1% of all fresh water is available to human beings for our use in a way that doesn't mean trying to tote icebergs. There was a scheme to tote an iceberg to Saudi Arabia, and when the market makes it profitable to do so, that something like that will probably happen. Then probably simply to state the obvious, there's nothing essential to life that is a substitute for water. I mean, that's one of the essentials for life, like air, where you just don't have anything else that can take its place. It's essential to all growth, all plant growth, all human growth. Thus, it's essential to all agriculture. It's essential to all food. It's essential to all bodily functions and systems, our health. It's essential to industry. And I think you can make the case that it's essential to culture. If you just started subtracting the references directly and indirectly to the rivers, we've seen rivers, to water in our stories, in our songs, in the images that we carry that are somehow imprinted upon us. I grew up on a river. When us kids got our garden, our weeding done in the garden, we couldn't go until we got our weeding done in the garden, but when we got our weeding done in their garden, then we could go swim in the gravel pit. That was worth weeding for, you know? there are just a lot of things that I think are sort of imprinted upon us that belong to shaping the kind of sensibilities that we have. So these mountains are called, they're not given a name for a mountain range. They're the Cascades. It's because of the water that they're called. These mountains are called the Cascades. And if you walk this nice little new trail down the 10 Mile Falls, it's a nice place you come to, and you come to the falls itself. The trail isn't called, could be called Goat Trail or some other trail. We have names like that, but it's called 10 Mile Falls Trail. Somehow the water is so important that it presses upon us, even the name. So, like air, it's essential and there is no substitute. Okay. Nyla, my wife and I wrote a piece about water, and I've asked Sonia if she would read the portion that Nyla wrote. Nyla's a labor and delivery nurse, and it isn't so important that Nyla and I wrote it. It is important that it's a labor and delivery nurse that wrote it. And Sonia is a nurse midwife, so she's been kind enough to do that part. And then I'll read the last part. And as you listen to this, I would ask two things. One, you may still want to use the baptismal font, the river, the tree, and the rocks. I even have a rock up here that says spirit and water on it, and it just dripped on my page. David Christian made these rocks. There are lots of interesting rocks, and if any of you read Hebrew, you find out something that I can't tell you. It may be, I don't know, it may be, should be censored. I have no idea. But there are lots of interesting rocks up here made by one of the potters. But as we read this, you might use that for your focal point. But I also ask you to be thinking about the questions which will be the questions for our discussion. What are your associations with water? Are there associations of the spirit with your associations with water? Are there spiritual and religious dimensions, if you will, to your pictures of water? Are there dimensions of life and death, is another way of asking the same question. Is water the subject of story and song and special places for you? Those sorts of questions. It's simply, broadly speaking, what are your associations of water? Because that's what we're going to use as our discussion. Sonia?
The women who birth their babies in the high-tech acute care hospitals where I have worked probably don't identify with the young girl who rode a donkey over the desert hills to Bethlehem the afternoon before her first birthing experience. Or with the woman so old, we are told, that she laughed when the stranger promised she would have a baby. Or with the woman sheltered from mortar fire in the basement of Sarajevo apartment building. The woman searching for food in the Eritrean desert. Or the woman in the crowded boat fleeing Haiti or Vietnam. Because I am a nurse midwife, I am allowed to participate in one of life's most sacred and intimate experiences. My water broke, the sign that birth is imminent, probably within the day. My water broke, a sign of life's promise. The waiting was over for Mary, for Sarah, and the unnamed women around the globe, for our mothers, grandmothers, and a host of other saints. The timing may not be good. It may be too soon. The premature baby may not live. And if it does, it may be with the pain of difficult breathing and continuous infection. It may be too soon for the schedule. Mary must have wished she could be home in Nazareth. The woman in the crowded boat to be safe before birth. The investment banker, her desk cleared and the work done. When I get discouraged by the hate, the violence, the tears and pain around our globe, I give thanks I can go to work and be renewed as people continue to give birth and the promise of a God who first broke the waters in creation is seen each time the waters are broken in birth. The promise is unchanged. The sign is unchanged. We have better tools so that babies are born healthier to participate in the promise of life. But birthing continues in the same way it has been since the beginning. I am renewed, knowing that birthing is not limited to just one kind of people, but spans a wonderful, vibrant spectrum of ages, colors, cultures, languages, political philosophies, and religious faith.
I, Larry, sent a postcard to Kelsey Mieko, our 16-month-old niece, from the Earth Summit in Rio. I told her this meeting was convened for her and her playmates. What would her world be like? What promises are we making to our children? Two images from the Earth Summit stay with me, and both are from the Global Forum. In contrast with Rio Centro and its endless parade of presidents and prime ministers to the podium, not a single national flag flew at the Global Forum meeting of non-governmental organizations in Flamengo Park, and there was no podium. There was only the same poster everywhere of a small marbled planet, blue, white, green, brown, seeming to float silently in space. In the center of the forum was the Tree of Life, with pilgrims from around the world, pilgrims of every kind, color, and age, making promises and singing, dancing, meditating, praying. Around the tree were messages, millions of messages, each scrawled on a paper leaf cut from the kind of construction paper you get in grade school, each from a child somewhere on that marbled planet, each from only one country, Earth. We talked about water in Rio. Seen from space, the planet could better be called water, not Earth. Its surface is 70% water. Most of its life is still in the waters, and all of its life emerged from the waters. These are the waters of life itself. Even our bodies carry an echo of that. They are also 70% water. In Rio, we talked about freshwater and the children. Only 2.5 of Earth's water is freshwater, and most of that is either frozen at the poles or inaccessible underground. Yet this 2.5% plus ocean evaporation comprises the waters of life for all life on the land. These precious waters are being polluted or lost at an alarming rate, breaking the promises we make to our children for a safe world. Nearly half the world's children do not have safe drinking water. And the threat to agriculture grows by the day for a world whose population will likely double to 10 billion within the lifetime of my niece. Matthew 1 is a recital of the genealogy of promise. The gospel writer recounts the generations of giving birth until the breaking of the waters of Mary's womb and the birth of Jesus. The Earth Summit was promise-making for generations yet to come, pledging on behalf of us all that the waters of life will not dry up or be rendered unsafe for use. Christians, washed in the waters of baptism, know these waters intimately. The waters of the earth are remembered and recited, Noah and the solitary ark of life, the rainbow of promise in the clouds, freedom through the sea for slaves from Egypt, and a promised fertile land, and Jesus, nurtured in the waters of a womb and baptized in the waters of a river. Jesus' own words are remembered, unless one is born of water and the Spirit, one cannot enter the dominion of God. Finally, the waters are recounted and made by parents, sponsors, the congregation, all of us, as we circle a font cradling the waters of life. Maybe next time we baptize, we should use the polluted water of some nearby river, or the still pure water of some nearby lake. Maybe, in the name of Jesus and face to face with one another, we should make some promises to the children on that marbled planet about the waters of life. My water broke, so private and personal, so sacred, so universal in time and space. All right, what are your associations with water? Yeah.
Some of you may have seen the petition out on the kiosk that I posted, and my name is Ann Agard, and I'm on the State Board of the League of Women Voters, and I carry the portfolio title of Chair of Shorelines.
Oh, so.
And so I have to tell you this little story, because I think it is interesting for you. I got this title because, and I basically, as a lay person, I've learned a great deal about what is called the Shoreline Management Act in the state of Washington, which was passed in 1971, and at the time was viewed as one of the most forward-looking pieces of legislation in terms of protecting the shorelines along the lakes and streams. And for example, the shoreline right here along American River is covered under that Shoreline Management Act. And if Holden wanted to do something within 200 feet of that shoreline, they would have to get what is called a shoreline permit.
For a railroad creek? For this creek?
Right, okay. For this creek.
All right.
And that permit goes through a whole series of things, which I won't tell you about now, but if anyone is really interested, I can cite it a chapter and verse. But the even more interesting thing is that the birthplace of this Shoreline Management Act is right down here on Lake Chelan. And it all came about with a very famous Supreme Court case called Wilbur versus Gallagher. And this Supreme Court case, the Washington State Supreme Court, came about because someone wanted to fill part of Lake Chelan right down where the town of Chelan sits down there, right off of 97. And without going to the details of the court case, the long and short of it was that there was a little footnote to the Supreme Court decision which said that it was not in the public interest of the state, of the citizens of the state of Washington, to allow the shorelines to be built upon without any controls. And that led to this Shoreline Management Act, which if you're a developer, you view as kind of the worst thing that ever descended upon the state of Washington. And if you're in the environmental camp, in which I am, you view it as a blessing. The final footnote to all of this is there is in the state of Washington, and is in a number of other states, something called the Public Trust Doctrine. The Public Trust Doctrine dates from the time of Justinian, around the year 400.
Whoa.
And I will give you that the United States expert is at the University of Washington. His name is Ralph Johnson, so you write this down in your notes, and you talk with him someday, because he says, before God created the waters, he created the public trust doctrine. But the essence of that doctrine says that there are things that are held in common to all of us that are cannot be given away. And that has to do primarily where it has been imposed has been in regard to navigable waters. Some of the leaders of this in the state of Wisconsin, each state must make their own decision about whether or not it is a judicial doctrine. It has to come through the judiciary. And each state must decide whether or not within their state constitutions they embody this public trust doctrine. Because the waters cannot be impinged upon, they cannot be given away. And in the state of California, not only can they not be given away, but they cannot be polluted. Mm-hmm. And this is this very famous Mono Lake case that has been going on for all eternity.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to follow up on that. Mm-hmm. And just so you know, you're sitting at the birthplace of this. This Lake Chelan, which is the birthplace of not only the Shoreline Management Act for the state, but what many believe is the public trust doctrine, which is alive and well in the state of Washington. And if you haven't signed my petition, please do it,
right,
because I'm leaving tomorrow.
Okay. And your
but you have to be a Washington resident.
Oh.
It's a marine waters protection and salmon habitat protection initiative.
I trust being 10 days at Holden doesn't make you a Washington resident.
No, sir.
No.
I wish you were. You're with us in spirit.
Yeah. The law of the sea, you know, is another of the, which is now, most all nations have ratified. The United States was holding back for a long time. Did Clinton finally sign it?
Did he? I don't know.
I think so.
This is also my husband, Knut, whose profession is as an oceanographer.
Oh, well, that sounds
an Arctic oceanographer.
Yeah. Well, let's hear from the oceanographers.
Is the Growth Management Act related to the act from Chelan, Waters Management from Chelan? Because last week, Chelan County was...
Oh, I know. That's a different. It's called the Growth Management Act.
Yeah. And Kitsap County also is trying to be...
You're exactly right. That is a different act than the Shoreline Management Act, but they're after us through that. But no, it's different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
I thought there was some difference, but sort of similar.
Yeah, that's right.
The significance of the Law of the Sea Treaty is... Mm-hmm. is because it then treats the oceans as a commons.
Right, it's similar kind of things.
Yeah.
But the public trust doctrine is, it does affect tidal lands and tidal waters.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly here in the state, there's a very famous case in Padilla Bay, which is up on just outside of Anacortes. But it is fresh water too. In fact, there's an Illinois case, was one of the early cases of there where the public trust doctrine was implied. So.
Well, I'm very intrigued by your question. I have a very different angle on this, much more personal one. I grew up in Washington, and my associations of water primarily have to do with identity, and particularly identity of being rooted in this area, in this place. And a lot of my memories growing up were all, my strongest memories are all associated with water. I grew up on near the banks of the Columbia River, and I can remember swimming in the Columbia, and then realizing a little bit later on that people were concerned about that because of the levels of pollution in the Columbia and radioactivity from campers and so on. That really brought my awareness. I can remember as a young boy swimming in the up around the San Juan Islands, or rowing in a rowboat around, and just being amazed at the imagery and the power of the waters. Mm-hmm. And I often swim with friends on the North Fork of the Lewis River, which is a tributary off Mount St. Helens, and in some of the lakes all around that area. And also having opportunities to visit the ocean on a very regular basis, and just being overwhelmed by the waters there. Mm-hmm. So for me, water is so much a part of what it means to live in the Northwest. It just seems like the primary element in terms of what it means to be a Northwesterner, or and in bigger instances of my life, in terms of who I see of myself, I see water as a thread weaving all of those generating images together.
First time I went to Europe was on a ship rather than on a plane. I'm not so old that I predate planes, but that's the way I got it. I grew up in southern Minnesota with the water that I mentioned, the river and the gravel pit, but I had never seen an ocean. And I don't know how many hours I stood at the rail and just watched the ocean. I had no idea that the ocean had that many moods, that many changes. It was a mystical experience.
Where in Minnesota did you grow up?
Southwest Minnesota.
Well, that's pretty wide, right? Be specific.
A little town called Petersburg. Jackson, Fairmont, Mankato, etc. But other associations with water.
Well, water to me is a very special gift, and it mirrors aspects of God. Mm. It's so close to life, almost life. It's motion, always motion, and so many of the important parts of it are hidden. We don't see the groundwater, which is so important. We don't see the water vapor in the atmosphere without which there wouldn't be life. We see the clouds when it condenses, but this magical, slightly asymmetric molecule, very simple substance, it's at the heart of our being.
That's a wonderful image for the hidden God, man. Talking about that. Yeah. On the way here, I was part of a doing a retreat at a Benedictine monastery near Madison, Wisconsin. Your comments made me think about that. When the little community gathered for the prayers, morning, noon, and evening, we gathered in this little chapel. And right at the entrance to the chapel was the baptismal font. And it was running water, the moving water. And there was just a trickle over the side, you know, because the water was always coming in and going out. And there was just the sound of the water flowing from the font down the side was present all the way through all of our prayers. And after a while, it just became part of the prayers themselves, that the sound of running water. Yeah, please.
It's cleansing.
Yeah. The means of cleansing, of purifying. Yeah.
Well, when my great acquiring ground, typically previously drained agricultural ground throughout Martin and Jackson County.
Oh, that's right.
And then coming back and seeing these babies restored and water back in them.
Ah. Yeah.
I was just going to say about becoming God, it's kind of interesting because I spent 1 year in Rhode Island, and what I discovered was sitting by the beach was the best stress reducer I have ever found. Mm. Just, I felt like everywhere I came in and went out, part of my week's stress went with it.
Why is that? Why is the presence of water calming? Or, you know, what is it that it takes out of us? Is it the motion?
Like sound.
The sound?
I think it's because we come out of water. And there have been studies done on the effects on the baby in the womb, the developing fetus. And we are aware long before anyone can even imagine of what's going on. And so when we are in the womb, we are cradled in water, and I'm sure we must hear the sloshing.
Or
the lapping.
Maybe more like a pulse beat that matches the wave pattern.
Oh. Sure. I'm sure we do.
So you think that's imprinted in us, and we retain that?
I think we do.
Throughout life. Yeah, Jenna.
And what was your statistic you gave earlier this week about the population of the United States being mostly along the water?
Yes. Not just the United States, about 30% of the total human population lives within 30 miles of a coastline. Mm-hmm. The human populations are concentrated on coastline.
Some of that is economic, but some of that is we choose to live near the water.
Uh-huh. Highly desirable.
Yet there are, you know, the contrasts are there. There are so many people in this world whom water is an enemy.
Yeah.
That is always a puzzle to me when I deal with people for whom water has the image of nastiness and wickedness and preventing them from doing something they want to do.
Oh, I see in that sense. Water is also associated with death. I mean, people drown or people get flooded. I mean, it's death and destruction. And one of the images of death is just sinking in the water. It's a powerful image. So images of life and death are both images associated with water. Yeah.
I was swimming in the ocean on the Gulf Coast, and I lived there for a year. And it was wonderful water to swim in, but you'd always have to watch out for these rip currents. And a few times, it was kind of scary. Am I going to make it back to shore? So
right.
There's that definite element of having to respect the water.
Yeah.
Just recently in Portland, we had a series of floods, and it was remarkable to see communities come out and just stare at the water, drop everything of what they're doing, and see the power of the water rushing through the city and carrying everything with it.
I think there's
people were just fascinated and awe of watching this roaring, powerful, seemed like transformed river.
Yeah.
That was not only a source of life, but also a source of so much tragedy.
Yeah. Yes, the power of water, both in those circumstances, a flood, but also just water running over the rocks. Mm-hmm. I mean, power and the strength of water, just the rippling water, it seems there.
One of my favorite musical compositions is the Die Moldau, and how it shows that the river starts as a little bubbling, like brook or even little spring, and it just builds and builds until finally it's a grand, grand river until it goes out into the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is an image in water mockery, because we consider ourselves as a society, we consider ourselves masters of this world in which we live.
Yeah.
And when you start talking about the kinds of events that turn that upside down, they typically are going to involve water. Whether it be that thunderstorm that lays the crop low, or the flood, the accumulation of all this water that mm-hmm. comes down
mm-hmm.
and sweeps away some feat of engineering that we have been mm-hmm. so proud of.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a mechanism of mockery.
Mm-hmm. You hear it, and Mary, you heard your hand up too. Did you hear earlier?
Well, I grew up, I guess, with an absence of water. You know, I'm talking about swimming and relaxing by the beach. I grew up in the Midwest in the rural community, and we had our own well, but some of our neighbors didn't, and so they carried water.
Mm-hmm.
Their entire water supply was carried from our well in buckets to their home. It was such a precious thing. I grew up, you never wasted water.
No.
You only filled your glass with what you were going to drink, and you didn't put too much water in the sink to wash dishes. It was just such a precious thing.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that. I'm deathly afraid of water, actually, to swim in. I have a pretty healthy fear, I guess, because it was such a precious thing. We never saw big lakes and oceans. We saw farm ponds, but
mm-hmm.
just a totally different aspect of both the preciousness, but then with that brings some fear for me. Now, not all rural people are afraid of water like I am, but for me it triggered kind of a healthy fear.
Yeah.
But you certainly don't waste it. And so during drought, farmers had to irrigate. You know, you had to create water, not create water, but you had to irrigate your crops. You had to create that nourishment.
Yeah.
The sky was
yeah.
real different than what you're all talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
the
washing machine system is so different now than when I was a kid at home growing up. Mother, the washing machine washed, and then you put the wringer around and you used it to rinse water.
Mm-hmm.
First you wash the white clothes, and then you wash the colored clothes, and then there's what's
overalls.
And then the last was
Bim overalls.
And then because we didn't have stationary tubs yet, we helped Mom carry the water out and water the sweet peas.
Right.
Well, you can't go back to that now, but it sure would be nice for people to realize that there are many more ways
yeah.
to save water than just not letting it drip quite so much.
I remember in India, you know, watching a boy with a quart of water do the entire sidewalk in front of the store. You know, I thought at home we'd have run, taken a hose there, and just how many gallons would have been used. He did the entire sidewalk with a quart of water.
There are still sun-saver machines.
There are what? Sun-saver
machines? Sun-saver machines. Yeah, we had one growing up in my house. It's the same thing, just retains the water.
Well, if you want to even buy a machine that maybe where you can save water, it's really hard to do it because the best they have is water savers, but they don't work weekly.
Uh-huh.
You know, so.
My memories of water, because I grew up in Indianapolis, which was at the time the largest city in the world not on the navigable waterway, which says something about when you can have a city and that is not on the navigable waterway. And this did not stop certain fanatics from sailing, however, on a reservoir. And so my real memory of water is sitting in a small wooden boat, waiting for the wind, because at 8 I was a really good light weather crew, with the hot sun of Indiana and that absolutely flat water, looking desperately all along for that little trail of wind across the water that might allow you to get home sometime in the next 30 hours. But I always associated water with silence and was so surprised to come to the ocean and find out it was noisy.
Yeah. That's great. Now, we've only got a few minutes left, and I want to tie our discussion and associations with water to the waters of life in the baptismal font. If, imagine that being a clear bowl rather than the ceramic one it is, so that you could see the waters from all sides and below. And if each of you put something in it, someone poured a little 2020 motor oil in there. And then someone else put in a soda can. Someone else in turn tossed in foil or a candy bar wrapper, or somehow some pesticides that you're using on the lawn were put in the baptismal font. Would you baptize with that water?
No. No.
Why not?
You might harm the infant.
What was your question?
You might harm the infant. I said, I would not do that.
Would not baptize it. It's you might do harm to the child. Yeah?
I think our image is of the gift of water is of pure water.
Hmm. Yes.
I think it would bother me.
Yeah. Is it a desecration?
It's defiled.
It's defiled. I mean, would you feel that that was a desecration if you polluted baptismal water?
In an emergency, it would work.
Uh-huh. Yes.
there's a saying we have one down in calligraphy by a sister-in-law, and it applies to water and applies to grace as well. And that is that abundance changes the value of things. And we don't appreciate the purity of water as long as it appears to be abundant.
No, yeah.
And the same is true of grace. That
yeah.
The abundance of grace leads us often to simply discount.
Yeah. Let me ask, is there a comment to the question of the desecration?
We brought a bottle of holy water, water from the Jordan.
Yeah.
Have our granddaughter baptized. It was terrible.
It was terrible. I can't help but tell you about the time when Nyla brought back some wine from Cana of Galilee. And we tasted that. It totally destroyed my Christology. Because if Jesus had change the wine into water, that would have been the miracle. But, well, that's an interesting angle on things, the water from the Jordan. But let me just put it this way. If it weren't baptismal water and you poured pesticides or the oil or the can into the water, would that be a desecration?
It's still defiled.
It's this connection we need to make between the waters of our sacraments and the waters of life, all of which together are the waters of life, that I hope we think about in talking about water washed and spirit born. What does being baptized in the waters of life mean for the way in which we use and treat the rest of the waters of life and the promises that we make to generations to come? Okay, I started out with the Celtics and said that tradition in Christianity was full of the images from nature as a part of the confessions themselves. We have one left over from that tradition in the Green Book, and it's the hymn that's attributed to St. Patrick. I bind myself today, I bind unto myself today the strong name of the Trinity, by invocation of the same, the three in one, the one in three. And just listen to the images, and I'll just read one verse. I bind unto myself today the virtues of the starlit heaven, the glorious sun's life-giving ray, the whiteness of the moon at even, the flashing of the lightning free, the whirling wind's tempestuous shocks, the stable earth, the deep salt sea, around the old eternal rocks. Now that's the way to confess your faith. Thank you.
Thank you.